Well, good morning, everybody. This is BioQ 41, and it is September 30th, and you're probably prepared for an exam today, but I'm not going to give an exam today. It was rescheduled for next week, Tuesday. All right, so hopefully you're all in tune with that, and the chapters that will be on exam number two will be 4, 5, and 7. We're going to cover chapter 9 today. Sign and sheet is going around, and chapter 9 is not on the test, right? So we're all on the right page. All right, so before I jump into chapter 9, which is the autonomic nervous system, do we have any questions? Do we have any questions? Well, then, you guys are just talking way too loud. Just hold on. I know you're trying to go over my voice, but you can't because mine is amplified. All right, so any questions? Yeah. Yeah, it's on this site right here. It's, http://, and then dr-j-gober.com. And you couldn't find them right there? I'm set up to give lecture, but before lecture, right after lecture, I'll double check, okay? But all the lectures should be there except for the one that I'm giving today, okay? But if you don't run out right after class, let's just double check because we have time after class to do that. I know, there's no pre-lecture reading assignments. That's not optimal for you guys. Yeah, I'll try to do the best I can for you, okay? So, but thanks for reminding me, yeah. Oh, the quantitative questions, I will. Okay? I will put up that key. All right, so let's start with autonomic nervous system. And this you should be fairly familiar with because it's an important part of the anatomy class. So you should know the structure of the autonomic nervous system, where nerves are coming and going. Okay, so I'll review just a little bit, but maybe not too much. But if you have questions, of course, I'll try to go over things. All right, so autonomic nervous system, we're just going to abbreviate ANS, manages our physiology for us. It takes care of most of our body. As a matter of fact, the other part of the nervous system, right, the somatic nervous system, only controls what?
Motor.
Only controls motor. Yeah, motor, but the autonomic nervous system has a motor division as well. Okay, so the somatic nervous system controls only voluntary organs. And what is the only voluntary organ in your body? Skeletal muscle, right? So the autonomic nervous system controls everything except for skeletal muscle, which is most of your body. So it regulates organs and organ systems by adjusting the activity of smooth muscle and glands, and you should also put on this slide, cardiac muscle. So the effector organs of the autonomic nervous system are smooth muscle, glands, and cardiac muscle. Okay, that's what you don't have direct control of. All right, smooth muscle. So let's talk about smooth muscle for just a little bit. Smooth muscle maintains a resting tone in the absence of nerve stimulation. So unlike skeletal muscle, which is completely relaxed, all right, smooth muscle can contract on its own to a little degree. And when smooth muscle becomes deinnervated, it becomes hypersensitive. All right, the contractility increases. So many types of smooth muscle are spontaneously active. That is unlike skeletal muscle, and it contracts rhythmically without any autonomic nervous system input. And that should remind you of another kind of muscle that is involuntary, and that is the heart. Right? The heart does not need innervation in order to contract. It's just that the autonomic nervous system will adjust the heart rate and the force of contraction. Right, so autonomic nervous system input simply increases or decreases that intrinsic activity of smooth muscle and cardiac muscle as well. Okay, so let's look at a comparison between the somatic nervous system and an autonomic nervous system. On the right over here, we see a typical outflow pattern or architecture for the somatic nervous system, which goes to skeletal muscle. We see the nerve cell bodies right here in the ventral root of the spinal cord. And how many nerves does it take to get all the way to the effector organ for somatic nervous system? just one. Okay, here's the cell body. It leaves the ventral root. Remember, the ventral root is the motor root of the spinal cord, and it goes all the way to this skeletal muscle, just one neuron. Right? And as a matter of fact, you should probably know by now what the neurotransmitter that is being used at the neuromuscular junction. That is going to be acetylcholine. We haven't covered that particularly in this class, but maybe you picked that up somewhere along the line. That's going to be acetylcholine. So let's contrast that with the outflow pathway for the sympathetic nervous system. And the question is, how many nerves does it take to get from the central nervous system to the effector organ right here? Well, we have the nerve cell body in this lateral horn, right, of the gray matter, and then the motor neuron will leave the ventral root once again, okay, enter the spinal nerve. So hopefully that's ringing a bell. And since this is not an anatomy textbook, they got the pathway a little wrong. That fiber goes through the gray ramus, which is this first ramus, into the sympathetic chain. It doesn't pass by this first one and enter the second one. It goes through the first one, so this is the gray ramus communicantes right here into the sympathetic chain. And before those sympathetic signals can reach the effector organ, there has to be a synapse, right? So we say that this cell that leads the central nervous system, this is the preganglionic fiber. And then after the synapse, we call this the postganglionic fiber. So it requires two. So somebody could turn that off. I'm trying to find, okay, very good. Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, that's quite all right. Okay, so in an autonomic outflow pathway, irrespective of whether it is sympathetic or parasympathetic, it requires two neurons, except for one special case that we're going to talk about. And this one that I'm showing you right here would be for sympathetic because I see it leaving from this level of the spinal cord. Okay. So it takes two neurons. Okay. The postganglionic axon then extends from the autonomic ganglion. Now, why do we call this a ganglion right here? Okay. Because we're in the peripheral nervous system, and a ganglion is by definition in the peripheral nervous system, and it is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And so here is a group of these nerve cell bodies, right where I have the arrow pointing right here. All right, and the sympathetic chain, sometimes we call the paravertebral ganglia because they run along either side of the vertebral column or spinal cord and kind of act like a spinal cord for the sympathetic nervous system. They're like auxiliary spinal cords for the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so that's just the general architecture. So just to review, somatic nervous system requires how many neurons to get to the effector organ? Just one, right? And somatic is voluntary. The autonomic nervous system always requires two, except for one exception. Okay, so let's just generally characterize the autonomic nervous system. Of course, you have to realize that there are two divisions. Right, I don't ever know an exception to this. Two divisions, and they are the sympathetic and parasympathetic. And they usually work in opposition to each other. They're antagonistic to each other, not 100% of the time, but mostly. And that's very important because what kind of control systems work the best, antagonistic or tonic? Antagonistic, because that provides for precise control and balance. All right, so let's generally characterize sympathetic and parasympathetic. The sympathetic we characterize as being the fight, flight, and stress nervous system. That's the nervous system that becomes activated when there's something threatening, right, in your environment. The parasympathetic, on the other hand, is responsible, or sometimes we call it the rest and digest nervous system. All right, so when you're not presented with any kind of threatening stimulus, that's the sympathetic. That's the autonomic nervous system that kind of takes over. So you could say rest and digest. You could also say rest and repose, right? Which is kind of like when you're falling asleep lying down, right? So rest and digest versus the fight and flight. So I think this is very helpful to keep these in mind when we think of the specific physiologic actions that these two different nervous systems mediate in our body. Okay, so for instance, when you are going to run away from a threatening circumstance, should your heart rate be higher or lower? higher, right? And that's mediated by the sympathetic nervous system. And for instance, when you are resting, should your heart rate be higher or lower?
Lower.
It should be lower, exactly right. Okay, so you can relate the effects of these two nervous systems to your everyday life pretty easily. All right, remember that let's just talk about sympathetic now. Focus in on the sympathetic nervous system. That can be also called the thoracolumbar division, right? Because the preganglionic fibers leave the central nervous system only from T1 to L2. None of these fibers leave through cranial nerves or cervical nerves, right? Or lumbar nerves, spinal nerves, right? So that's why we call it thoracolumbar. Most synapses on the postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic chain, or sometimes we call that the paravertebral ganglia, because they lie on either side of the vertebral column. And all of these different levels of ganglia interconnect with each other. Right? So that's why we have the ganglia on either side of the spinal cord. And because they interconnect with each other, when the sympathetic nervous system is activated, it is activated pretty much as a unit. We call that mass activation. And that is possible because the sympathetic nervous system has a high level of divergence and convergence of neural fibers because of all those ganglia and the sympathetic chain ganglia. So let's take a look at this slide right here. What do we mean by divergence? Well, we have the preganglionic fiber leaving the spinal cord, and you can see it, what, bifurcate many times. Right? It can pass right through the sympathetic chain to go to what we call a collateral ganglia, which is going to be closer to the organ that's receiving that innervation. Or it can synapse within the sympathetic chain, right, to stimulate a postganglionic fiber. Or instead of passing right through, it can arise through the sympathetic chain or descend to inferior levels of the sympathetic chain, sending that signal to multiple places. Therefore, all of these different areas of your body will be activated because of the divergence of signals. Right? All parts of your body will receive that sympathetic stimulation. All right, so in this diagram, what are some keys that you should be aware of? Well, you have the solid nerve fiber. All right, how would you classify the solid colored fiber right here? That is the preganglionic fiber, and the dotted line right here is the postganglionic, so there has to be a synapse between them, and this synapse right here is not an electrical synapse, it is a chemical synapse. So how does a signal get from the preganglionic into the postganglionic? Via a neurotransmitter, right? So we're going to be interested in neurotransmitters a lot, and since a neurotransmitter can only affect this postganglionic cell if the postganglionic cell has what membrane component?
Receptor.
It's got to have a receptor, so we're going to be interested in receptors as well. So neurotransmitters and receptors that control signals in the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so this slide right here shows divergence very nicely, and this next slide right here does not show convergence at all, but, oh, except right, maybe right here it shows convergence of a signal right here, where preganglionics actually can merge back together within the collateral ganglia, right? And as a result of that, that also produces mass activation within the sympathetic nervous system. Okay, so we talked about the paravertebral ganglia in the sympathetic chain, but there are also other ganglia right here where there is that junction that it synapses between the preganglionic and postganglionic fibers in other parts of the body, and we call these collateral ganglia or sympathetic ganglia in addition to the sympathetic chain. These are here only if, for instance, the preganglionic fiber passes directly through the sympathetic chain, right? If it doesn't synapse in the sympathetic chain but passes through, remember that is a characteristic of the autonomic nervous system, is that there has to be a ganglion someplace between the central nervous system and the effector organ. And if it passes through the sympathetic chain, this is where it lies, within the collateral ganglia right here. And probably you should know the name of that nerve that's a preganglionic fiber or carries preganglionic fibers to a collateral ganglion. So I guess that would be a good question that I I don't know if I'd put on the test, but I want to ask you right now just to get you thinking in terms of anatomy just a little bit. All right, there are nerve fibers. All right, there are nerves composed of preganglionic fibers that pass through the sympathetic chain and go to a collateral ganglion. Does anybody know the general name of that kind of nerve? We use it a lot. It's called a splanchnic nerve, right? A splanchnic nerve, and there are a number of splanchnic nerves depending on what level of the abdomen we're talking about. So you don't have to know any in particular. All right, so we said that in almost all cases, it requires two autonomic nervous system fibers to go from CNS to the effector organ, with one exception. And this is the exception right here, the innervation of the adrenal medulla. Right? And the medulla is what part of the adrenal gland? So let's just think of anatomy a little bit more. What the medulla is what part of an organ or a gland? That is, the deep part, right? That's the deep part of the adrenal gland, not the adrenal cortex, which is the superficial part. So the adrenal gland is doing a number of things for us, and the deep part, all right, is associated with the sympathetic nervous system. There are cells in the adrenal medulla called chromaffin cells that are actually acting like the postganglionic fiber of a typical autonomic pathway. And they receive signals from the preganglionic fiber, and when they are stimulated, they release epinephrine and norepinephrine into capillaries. And capillaries then take epinephrine and norepinephrine where? All over the body. So these are, usually we think of norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter, but in this particular case, since it's being picked up by the circulatory system and delivered through the whole body, it is acting like a hormone. Right? And since the chromaffin cells are really just a modified neuron, we should think of norepinephrine in this case as really a neurohormone and not just purely a neurotransmitter or a hormone. So here is a nice interface between the endocrine system and the nervous system. And a lot of times in some classes we don't break the endocrine system down into one system and the nervous system down into a separate system because they work together and they interact, and this is a good example of the interface between the nervous system and endocrine system, which you should really think about as what the neuroendocrine system, at least right here with the adrenal medulla. And the adrenal medulla is stimulating during mass activation, and it releases the sympathetic signaling agent, norepinephrine, and epinephrine, which goes everywhere in your body, which then does what? It enhances this mass activation effect of the sympathetic nervous system. So it goes everywhere that blood goes, as long as the target tissue has what? A receptor, okay, for epinephrine and norepinephrine. Okay, so epinephrine is made by methylating norepinephrine, starting with tyrosine right here. And what could somebody tell me about tyrosine? It's an amino acid, and it's an essential amino acid. Your body can't make it. You have to have it on your diet. And through various modification steps, changing the functional groups on some of these carbon atoms right here, you see that epinephrine can be made quite easily from norepinephrine just by methylating it in this position right here. Okay, so these compounds are all related. So probably from from the discussion we had last time, dopamine can be used as a neurotransmitter or is used as a neurotransmitter in certain parts of the brain. Norepinephrine is, and epinephrine we see is a signaling molecule. And I would say in this particular case, you'd have to call it a neurohormone. Okay, the parasympathetic division is not thoracolumbar in terms of its anatomy. All right, outflow from the parasympathetic, the central regions of the parasympathetic control, right, is craniosacral. So cranial nerves can carry parasympathetic information, and sacral nerves can carry parasympathetic. These long preganglionic fibers originate in the midbrain or medulla and pons, leaving cranial nerves, and also from S2 through S4, and these are what? Sacral nerves, way inferior. Okay, and they also have a ganglion, and maybe you can remember from anatomy that these ganglia are not along the spinal cord or in the cavities of your body, like abdominal cavity, but they are even within the target organ, right? So we call them terminal ganglia. So the sympathetic preganglionic fibers are relatively short. The parasympathetic preganglionic fibers are relatively long because they find their way all the way to the target organ. Right? And therefore, because the preganglionic fibers are really long, that means then that the postganglionic fibers are very, very short, right? Could be microscopically short because they don't have to go very far. They're already in the target organ. Probably the most important parasympathetic nerve in the body is cranial nerve 10, the vagus nerve, and it just wanders around all over the body. It innervates most of the body for parasympathetic stimulation, right? It innervates the heart, lungs, esophagus, stomach, pancreas, liver, small intestine, upper half of the large intestine. And the sacral divisions of parasympathetic outflow innervate only the lower part of the large intestine, right? And urinary bladder and some reproductive organs as well. Okay, and that name vagus actually means, what, vagabond or wanderer. It just kind of wanders around carrying parasympathetic information all over the body. So here is a slide, a composite slide. I'm not sure if this is one in your book or if I stole it from someplace else that is reminiscent of one that's in your textbook that basically shows blue right here is what division of the autonomic nervous system. That's the parasympathetic, right, because it is cranial sacral. And the solid colored nerves right here are preganglionic fibers. The red thoracolumbar is the sympathetic nervous system. And in every case, it goes into the sympathetic chain where it might synapse. Like for instance, here's a synapse. I know there's a synapse in this ganglia right here because the dotted line represents a postganglionic fiber. At other times, it passes straight through to a collateral ganglia. So this is a preganglionic fiber right here, but all these bundles of axons we call splanchnic nerves, right, if they pass through the sympathetic chain going to a collateral ganglia someplace. All right, so now I think we're ready to start to look at neurotransmitters, right, that are going to be used within these various synapses. Oh, one last thing I didn't point out. All right, well, if we look at a blue fiber right here, which is what a parasympathetic, it looks like it requires only one neuron to get from the central nervous system to the effector organ. But if you look closely, what do you see right here in the urinary bladder? You see a postganglionic fiber. You do see a dotted line, but it's really hard to draw because what? These fibers are microscopically small, right? But that is the postganglionic fiber right within the organ. Well, in the uterus, you can see very nicely. Right, or maybe you can see them pretty easily anyway if you're not colorblind. Okay, and the lung. Here's a short postganglionic parasympathetic fiber in the lung. All right, so those are good ways to describe the structural differences between the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. And now some functional differences. We said that mostly the effects of parasympathetic and sympathetic are what? Antagonistic to each other. Okay, so let's point maybe a few of these things out. How about, let's look at the heart. So here is heart, and the heart can be controlled by adjusting chronotropy, which is the rate, right? Chronograph is a timepiece of some kind, like a watch, all right? And so that's chronotropy. Sympathetic nervous system increases heart rate, but the parasympathetic decreases heart rate. So that's a nice antagonistic control. All right, in terms of speed of conduction of impulses through the conduction system, sympathetic increases the rate, while parasympathetic slows the conduction through the heart. But now here's something pretty interesting. The sympathetic nervous system can also increase the inotropy of the heart. It's a positive inotrope, so it increases force of contraction. But what about the parasympathetic nervous system right here? There are no fibers that go to the ventricles of the heart to decrease force of contraction. All right, so the heart by autonomic stimulation can only increase heart rate. And then to decrease it, then there's no parasympathetic innervation that can force the heart to decrease its force of contraction, only the rate of contraction. In bronchioles, these are airways within the lungs, sympathetic causes dilation of bronchioles, and parasympathetic causes constriction. And in glands within the lungs, right, sympathetic inhibits secretion while parasympathetic stimulates. So one thing that's important that you might be noticing right now is that sometimes the sympathetic effects on an organ will be excitatory, but at other times it will be inhibitory. Okay, so that's, and they're going to be using the same neurotransmitters having opposite effects. That means that there are different receptors in these different kinds of tissues. Right? So it doesn't mean that the sympathetic will always be excitatory, and it doesn't mean that the parasympathetic will always be inhibitory. The only thing you know for sure, if you're going to take a wild guess, is what? The sympathetic will be antagonistic to parasympathetic. Right? So sometimes these things switch back and forth. Now, why would that be? Why might the sympathetic nervous system be excitatory on the heart but inhibitory on some smooth muscle in the lungs? Well, let's just say we just got a fire alarm and we got to run out of the building. What nervous system will be activated? The sympathetic, right, the fight or flight nervous system, okay? And so it makes perfect sense that our heart rate should increase to deliver glucose and oxygen nutrients to muscles in our brain and heart, all right? But why should smooth muscle in our lungs be inhibited? Because when they're inhibited, those airways dilate, and as they dilate, they can conduct air much more efficiently to our lungs, right? So the lungs, the smooth muscle will be inhibited to increase ventilation of our lungs so that we can extract more oxygen from the atmosphere to deal with that flight or fight circumstance. All right, so I would always rely on those nice characterizations of the autonomic nervous system to understand why sometimes sympathetic stimulation is excitatory and why sometimes in other organs it is inhibitory. Okay, the only thing you can say for sure is that sympathetic and parasympathetic should always be antagonistic to each other. So if you know how it works on one system, flip the coin and you know how the parasympathetic works on that particular system. Okay, so we said parasympathetic. How would you characterize the parasympathetic nervous system? Rest and digest. So let's look at some things of the digestive system. Where do we have digestive system? How about stomach and intestine right here? We said that the parasympathetic nervous system will be excitatory, right? So it will stimulate secretion. It will stimulate secretion in the stomach and the intestines and motility in the gastrointestinal tract is stimulated by parasympathetic nervous system. All right, but if you're presented with a life-threatening circumstance, all right, you need to have an active digestive system. No, that's like the last place that you want blood going to, right? You need it going to your brain, your heart, skeletal muscles. Okay, so sympathetic will inhibit motion of the gastrointestinal tract. It will close sphincters. Okay, the other thing that's kind of interesting right here is that sympathetic stimulation can increase the breakdown of glycogen. I don't know why they don't use the proper term. What would be the proper term there? Glycogenolysis, which does what to blood glucose? It's going to increase blood glucose. So sympathetic stimulation does increase blood glucose. All right, it does stimulate lipolysis, which then has a tendency to increase blood glucose. Okay, so sympathetic stimulation does increase blood glucose levels as a result of that. All right, so this is a pretty handy table, and you might actually want to print this out, enlarge it, and hang it someplace in your house and look at it for maybe 5 years or so until you become really familiar with these other effects, because you can really explain a lot of side effects that important medications affect on various patients. Okay? Okay, so let's look at some neurotransmitters right here. So both sympathetic and parasympathetic preganglionic fibers release acetylcholine. All right, so the preganglionic fiber is the first fiber, all right, and it releases that neurotransmitter in these various ganglia right here. And remember, blue is the parasympathetic and red is sympathetic, so these are terminal ganglia within the visceral organs that the parasympathetic nervous system is innervating. And these right here are in the sympathetic nervous system, so they're either within the sympathetic chain or the paravertebral ganglia someplace, or prevertebral ganglia someplace. And in every single case, these preganglionic fibers are releasing acetylcholine. And the kind of nerve fiber that releases acetylcholine, we call those cholinergic fibers. So all preganglionic fibers are cholinergic, which means that these dendrites of the postganglionic fibers have to have a receptor for acetylcholine. And we learned of two receptors last time. There are nicotinic receptors and muscarinic receptors. Nicotinic are purely receptor channels, right? And muscarinic rely on G proteins. All of these receptors on the postganglionic fibers are nicotinic receptors. But they are just sodium channels or cation channels that open up when two molecules of acetylcholine bind to them. Okay, most sympathetic postganglionic fibers, as a matter of fact, let me finish with the parasympathetic first. So here we have the postganglionic parasympathetic fiber, and it releases acetylcholine. All right, and so both the preganglionic and postganglionic fibers for parasympathetic nerves are cholinergic. Right, and so these visceral organs over here have to have either nicotinic or muscarinic receptors. And if it is skeletal muscle, it's a nicotinic receptor, but for most visceral organs, it's going to be a G protein couple. It's going to be some kind of muscarinic receptor. Okay, so now let's talk about sympathetic nervous system. Okay, the preganglionic fiber in every case is cholinergic, but the postganglionic fiber in a lot of cases, most cases, releases norepinephrine. So the preganglionic fiber is cholinergic because it releases acetylcholine, but the postganglionic fiber, since it releases norepinephrine, we call those adrenergic. So these are adrenergic nerves right here because it releases norepinephrine. There's a couple of weird postganglionic sympathetic nerves that release other kinds of neurotransmitters. There's a few in skeletal muscle that release acetylcholine. There are a few in the kidney that release dopamine. Okay, but most you could just say are what? Adrenergic. That's just a nice way of thinking about it. Okay, so in every case that we see right here, we see one preganglionic fiber and a postganglionic fiber for parasympathetic. When we go to sympathetic, we see a preganglionic and a postganglionic fiber, right? A preganglionic, postganglionic fiber, except for one circumstance which is really important. And that is, within the sympathetic nervous system, we see one sympathetic preganglionic fiber, right, passing through the sympathetic chain, and it goes to the adrenal medulla. And in the adrenal medulla right here, I don't see a postganglionic fiber anyplace. I don't see a fiber with a dotted line, right? Nonetheless, this preganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine, so it is communicating with cells within the adrenal medulla. Those are those chromaffin cells, and when they depolarize, they release epinephrine and norepinephrine just into their surroundings. And there are capillaries, of course, in the adrenal medulla, so these hormones go into the blood, and then they're taking that, these neurohormones are taken everywhere in the body, stimulating these adrenergic receptors wherever, you know, wherever they exist, like smooth muscle, heart, whatever. And epinephrine has a relatively long lifetime once it's in the blood compared to epinephrine that's in the synapse. Remember, how is norepinephrine dealt with once it's released into the synapse? How is its action terminated? Through reuptake, right? And monoamine oxidase breaks down norepinephrine within the preganglionic fiber. Epinephrine, on the other hand, can last for a long time in the circulatory system. So you will feel the effects. Maybe you have noticed, have you ever been driving down the freeway and all of a sudden you're maybe in the middle lane and there's a couple of semi-tractor trailers and they're both making a turn into you and it looks like you have no place to go and you think you're going to die for sure. And you slam on the brakes and guess what? You're still here. All right, but right after that happens, what has happened to your heart rate? It increases, right? And the force of contraction, what has happened? Is your heart is like pounding out of your chest. So your heart rate goes up, the force of contraction goes up, and you can probably remember that that lasted for more than just a couple seconds. You probably had to take a number of deep breaths just to make sure that you were in control of your body, not driving off the road, right? And it took minutes or a half hour. And if you really had to do something with a lot of dexterity, it would maybe take a couple hours for your body to recollect itself because of the lifetime of epinephrine in the blood as a hormone. So it's a little bit longer acting. Okay, so this pathway right here that includes the adrenal medulla is just what? One preganglionic fiber, and the cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fiber, releasing these neurohormones right here. So this is a nice exam figure, right? So you should know parasympathetic and sympathetic, where they exist with regard to the spinal cord, what neurotransmitters are released, something about these different ganglia when we get to take this test in about a month or so, okay? And you should know that the adrenal medulla releases epinephrine as well as norepinephrine, and where does epinephrine and norepinephrine from the adrenal medulla go? Into the circulation, into the circulatory system, okay? Now, there's a difference between synapses that we see at the neuromuscular junction and in the brain. Those kinds of synapses are characterized by having a little terminal button. There are synaptic vesicles at the end of an axon, but neurons for the autonomic nervous system do not have synaptic terminals or synaptic boutons or buttons that have neurotransmitter. They have little swellings that we call varicosities that exist along the length of an axon near the target organ. And so these little swellings or varicosities right here contain synaptic vesicles. And when an action potential moves down an axon, each one of these varicosities right here will release neurotransmitter right into the extracellular fluid. And so these kinds of synapses, you can see, can excite a whole string of tissues that they pass by. And so sometimes we call these synapses en passant. Right? So there's synapses in passing, and an autonomic neuron can stimulate many different kinds of cells within an organ at one time as a result. Okay, and for the somatic nervous system, what's somatic again? Skeletal muscle, right? Voluntary. Whenever an action potential reaches the neuromuscular junction, there is sufficient acetylcholine released and sufficient nicotinic receptors opening up that every time a motor neuron is stimulated, it's going to cause contraction of a skeletal muscle cell. So a skeletal muscle can never make up its own mind whether it's going to contract or not. If it gets a signal from a motor neuron, it's going to contract, right? So that's a good thing, because after the test on Tuesday, you're going to send signals to skeletal muscles in your leg saying, hey, I'm done with the test, I want to go home, and what are your muscles going to allow you to do? They're just going to obey your command, and you're going to get up and go home, okay? That's not necessarily what happens with the autonomic nervous system, because we see that for most organs, it has sympathetic innervation as well as parasympathetic innervation, right? So we have synapses and passant, both of these, right? They're going to be releasing two kinds of neurotransmitters, right? One might be excitatory and the other is inhibitory. They're going to have antagonistic effects within this target tissue right here. And this target tissue then gets to make up its own mind as to what signal is more important, right? And that will be just due to the overriding influence of one system or the other. All right, so that's something that skeletal muscles can't do. Smooth muscles can look at the input from the sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system and then make up its mind, what should it do? Should it contract or should it relax? Skeletal muscle, on the other hand, will always do what? will always contract, right? It can't make up its mind. It cannot do anything else. So that's another difference between the somatic and autonomic nervous system. Okay, let's focus on the receptors of the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so we're going to be talking about adrenergic control. All right, and adrenergic effects can cause both excitation or inhibition, depending on the tissue. All right, so how is it that a particular neurotransmitter, right, so an adrenergic nerve is going to release what kind of neurotransmitter? Okay, yeah, let's start before that. How about a cholinergic fiber? A cholinergic nerve fiber is going to release what kind of neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine, yeah? And an adrenergic fiber is going to release norepinephrine. Yeah, norepinephrine, or you could call it noradrenaline if you want to, okay? And that norepinephrine can be excitatory or inhibitory on a tissue. So how is it that one neurotransmitter can have opposite effects on different tissues? Because different tissues could have different types of receptors. That's exactly right. All right, because different subtypes of receptors for the same neurotransmitter exist. And there are two main kinds of adrenergic receptors. There's alpha and beta, okay? And probably the first ones that were discovered were just called alpha. And then they discovered some later that were called beta. Right? And as a matter of fact, we know a lot more about these alpha and beta receptors. There are even subtypes for alpha and beta receptors that you have to become a little familiar with. Now, why is that important? Seems awfully complicated, but why is this important to know something about these different kinds of receptors, different kinds of alpha receptors and beta receptors in your body? Because the autonomic nervous system controls most of your body. Right? And so if you didn't know something about these, you wouldn't know how most of your body is controlled and functions. So this is of prime importance to get a good feel for this. Okay. In any case, all adrenergic receptors are G protein coupled, right? Which means they work through second messenger systems. So where do you find a second messenger? Inside the cell. And in particular, what first messenger are we talking about? What first messenger are we talking about? And where do you find it? Okay. So we're talking about an adrenergic receptor. An adrenergic receptor is going to be sensitive to what first messenger? There's maybe two, but one from a neuron. That's going to be norepinephrine. So norepinephrine is the first messenger. But if it's coming from the adrenal medulla, it could be norepinephrine or epinephrine. These are first messengers. They don't go inside the cell, but those things stimulate the production of second messengers that are inside the cell. And way back when, I think I gave you a list of second messengers, all right, and probably your favorite one is cyclic AMP, and another one is calcium ion, all right, that build up inside the cell. So second messenger is always inside, first messenger is always outside. Okay. And these build up due to G protein coupled receptor proteins. Okay, so what do I want you to know? The alpha receptors use calcium as second messengers. Right, so when an alpha adrenergic receptor is stimulated, it's going to cause the buildup of calcium inside the cell, maybe allowing calcium to diffuse through calcium channels that open up, or maybe the release of calcium from endoplasmic reticulum, smooth endoplasmic reticulum inside of a muscle cell of some kind, like a cardiac muscle cell. Beta adrenergic receptors use cyclic AMP. And we're going to have some figures later on, maybe not in this chapter, but in other chapters that show this mechanism right here. All right, so I do want you to become familiar with some effects of beta stimulation and alpha stimulation, and indeed alpha 1, beta 1, and beta 2. So you could maybe put a little underline or circle or highlight alpha 1, beta 1, and beta 2 receptors we got to become familiar with. And we're not going to spend a lot of time with alpha 2 receptors. Important alpha 2 receptors are mostly in the brain. So these are central receptors, and I think we're just going to focus our attention on peripheral receptors that are in target tissues. I'll just say a couple of things about alpha 2. Okay, so in the eye, contraction of radial fibers of the iris So the radial fibers kind of look like spokes. Remember, your iris is a nice circular kind of structure. The radial fibers are the muscle fibers that act like bicycle spokes, and when they contract, right, that will dilate pupils. Right, and that's because the iris has alpha-1 receptors. So that's going to cause contraction of those smooth muscle fibers. So alpha-1, would you say that typically alpha-1 is inhibitory or excitatory? Excitatory. It's going to cause smooth muscles to contract, right? And that's going to dilate your pupils as a result. Okay, now let's follow some more alpha-1s. So here's another alpha-1. Skin and visceral blood vessels. Arterioles constrict due to smooth muscle contraction. That's due to alpha-1. So is that case excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. And is that what we talked about in the first case? Yes. So alpha-1 looks really good for what? Excitation. What's another case right here? Skeletal muscle blood vessels. All right. Arterioles constrict due to sympathetic nerve activity. That's an alpha-1 receptor. That's excitatory again. So if you're going to just pick one thing, one kind of concept for an alpha-1 receptor, let's talk about stomach and intestine right here. Contraction of sphincters, right, which slows down digestion and passage of food, right? So that inhibits digestion, but it inhibits digestion because what? These alpha-1 receptors cause excitation of smooth muscle that slows the digestive process down, right? So alpha-1 receptors, for every case that you want to know about, are excitatory, right? They cause smooth muscle to contract. Now, did we talk about the lungs or the heart yet? No, we didn't talk about that yet. We talked about the eye, right? Talked about blood vessels, and we talked about smooth muscle of the gastrointestinal tract. All right, so we got some more things to look at. What about the heart? Okay, how many hearts do you have? One. Very good. Okay, that's a hint. Okay. And it's not an alpha receptor that are in the heart, but primarily it's a beta receptor. And since you have one heart, it's going to be easy to remember that there are beta-1 receptors in the heart. And beta-1 receptors in the heart, when they're stimulated with norepinephrine or epinephrine, it increases the rate, right? That's the chronotropy of the heart. It also increases force of contraction. So it increases both the inotropy and chronotropy of the heart. That's due to beta-1 receptors. All right, now, that's the only beta-1 that I have on this list right here. But we have another beta receptor, right? That's a beta-2. Let's look at the lungs right here. The bronchioles dilate due to smooth muscle relaxation. So what's the effect of norepinephrine or epinephrine on the smooth muscle of bronchioles? Is it excitatory or inhibitory? It's inhibitory. It has the opposite effect, right? That's a beta-2. And what's a really nice, easy way to remember that's a beta-2 and not a beta-1? Because you have two lungs, right? You got a right and a left. So that's pretty easy to remember that. Okay, so you got to remember that beta-1 and beta-2, even though they're both betas, even though they both work through what? Cyclic AMP, they don't have the same effects on their target tissue. And you could probably guess why that is. Maybe one opens a sodium channel, the other opens a potassium channel. One will be excitatory, the other will be inhibitory. Yeah.
So beta-1
is excitatory. Yep, because it increases heart rate, increases force of contraction. Yeah. Oh, the alpha-2s? I would say for right now, you should just know that they're located centrally, and centrally I mean central nervous system as opposed to periphery in the peripheral parts of your body where most of these other receptors are. And the alpha-2s, when they are stimulated, right, it decreases sympathetic activity. So I guess I could talk about the alpha-2s just a little bit. I don't think I'll ever test you on an alpha-2 type of receptor. But when an alpha-2 receptor is stimulated, it really cuts back sympathetic tone all over your body. All right, so if increasing sympathetic tone stimulates beta-1 receptors, which increases heart rate and force of contraction. All right, can you imagine what might happen to your blood pressure? If your heart rate goes up and force of contraction goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up. Okay, if we constrict arterioles, All right, think of a water balloon. If you squeeze down on a water balloon, what happens to the pressure inside the water balloon? Does it go up or down? It goes up, right? So under most circumstances, sympathetic stimulation causes an increase in blood pressure. But since the alpha-2s inhibit the sympathetic nervous system, when alpha-2s are stimulated in the brain, it inhibits the sympathetic nervous system. Guess what happens to blood pressure? Usually sympathetic nervous system causes an increase, but when it's inhibited, blood pressure goes down. So stimulation of alpha-2 receptors causes a decrease in blood pressure. That's probably where you would run into it most frequently. So when somebody has an episode of acute hypertension, there are drugs that affect alpha-2 receptors, which can cause a precipitous drop in blood pressure, which is okay if somebody has what? Really, really high, dangerously high blood pressure. And one drug that would do that, for instance, would be clonidine. Maybe some of you have family members that maybe take clonidine even. But since you can imagine, since those effects are pretty drastic, a lot of people have a hard time tolerating that kind of drug. But if your blood pressure is so high that a blood vessel is about to explode, right, then that's something that you would elect for that person, because it's much better than having a blood vessel explode on you. Okay, so these receptors are pretty important. So alpha-1s, let's just reiterate again. So alpha-1s primarily are excitatory, right? We see them primarily in blood vessels. Alpha-2, you don't really have to know much about, but they're interesting. I'm sure that you'll learn more and more about them. Alpha-1s are excitatory. Beta-1s are excitatory. Beta-2s are inhibitory. So beta-1s excitatory primarily on the heart, beta-2s inhibitory primarily on the lungs, right? So that's why somebody that is suffering from an acute attack of emphysema or something might take epinephrine as an inhalant, because it's going to bind to the beta-2 receptors in the lungs, and it's going to cause bronchodilation, right? And that will allow them to breathe much more easily. And a lot of pharmaceutical agents, right, we would like to have it target a particular kind of receptor in the body, right? We don't like to just give, for instance, norepinephrine, because it will stimulate all of these receptors. But other pharmaceutical agents, we would like to have it target specifically one kind of receptor, so there's no cross-reactivity with other kinds of organs. All right, so that's adrenergic stimulation. Here is a really nice exam figure that will help you remember some of these things, right? So you have to label this for exam number 3. All right, so what kind of outflow pathway do we see right here? Autonomic or somatic? What do I mean by somatic? Somatic just means voluntary. It's a skeletal muscle. All right, and what do we have right here? And why? Is it somatic or autonomic? It's autonomic because I see 2 nerve fibers, right, back to back. And somatic, there's only 1 from the central nervous system all the way to the effector organ. Okay? And so these are all autonomic outflow pathways. So here's the preganglionic fiber. This is the postganglionic fiber. What do we call this area right in here? Okay, that's where the autonomic ganglia would be, right? So these are the synapses. Here's a nerve cell body that's going to make a swelling in this region right here. So it's going to form a ganglion. And so these are nice chemical synapses. And we see the parasympathetic outflow pathway and 3 different kinds of sympathetic pathways right here. But in every case, what are the preganglionic fibers? How would you characterize the preganglionic fibers? And the way you would do that is one of 2 ways. They're either going to be cholinergic or adrenergic. Another way of asking that is, what's the neurotransmitter that's going to be released by each of these preganglionic fibers? Okay, and it's going to be acetylcholine. Right, so I see acetylcholine here, and you could maybe draw in on your notes acetylcholine, acetylcholine, acetylcholine. All right, there's no variation there, which makes it nice and easy to remember that. The other thing is that the receptors on the postganglionic cells, right, this one, this one, this one, this one, there's only 1 kind of receptor, and that is a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, right, which is just a receptor channel. And that channel opens up when two molecules of acetylcholine bind to it. Right? So in this particular case, is acetylcholine going to be excitatory or inhibitory on these postganglionic neurons? Or can it switch back and forth? It's going to be 100% excitatory in every case because that's how a nicotinic receptor operates, right? It just allows depolarization of this postganglionic cell right here. Okay. Now, these postganglionic cells, of course, the parasympathetic division will release acetylcholine. For the sympathetic division, they're going to release norepinephrine, except in a few circumstances that we're not going to dwell on. So you could say, right, norepinephrine is the postganglionic fiber neurotransmitter, and acetylcholine is the parasympathetic postganglionic fiber neurotransmitter. Right. Now, acetylcholine here for the autonomic nervous system will only stimulate muscarinic receptors, right? And that will then drive these parasympathetic nerve effects. And these muscarinic receptors can either be excitatory or inhibitory. And I'll show you what that looks like in a little bit. So for instance, excitatory on smooth muscle of the digestive tract, but inhibitory on the heart. All right, so these muscarinic receptors could be excitatory or inhibitory, depending on the receptor. All right, let's look at the adrenergic receptors right here. Alpha 1, what did we say? Excitatory, primarily where blood vessels, right? It's going to cause vasoconstriction. The beta 1, where do we have beta 1 receptors? In the heart, okay? And we said it was excitatory, increased heart rate and contractility. So these little blue dots right here, too bad on the test you can't see blue or red, right? I bet these are red dots. They're green? Ha-ha. And these are green too then, I guess, up over here. They're all blue. Okay, well, they should be the same as down over here. Okay. All right, so these blue represent norepinephrine and these green represent acetylcholine, right? All right, in the last circumstance, the beta-2 adrenergic receptors that you have in the lungs, right, these inhibit smooth muscles of bronchioles causing dilation, which then helps ventilation. So when you're faced with a fight or flight circumstance, right, all of these receptors are going to be stimulated. Alpha 1s, vasoconstriction to viscera and skin. Do you need to have blood going to the skin when you're running away from something? Where do you need most of your blood going to? Heart, brain, and skeletal muscles that allow you to run, right? So these, when these blood vessels vasoconstrict in the skin, that's good because now more blood can go to the brain and heart and skeletal muscle to do their job. All right, what about stimulation of the beta-1 receptor? Sure, your heart rate should increase to deliver more nutrients to the rest of your body when it's a stressful circumstance. And what about stimulation of beta-2? Why should smooth muscle be inhibited in the lungs? Because that enhances ventilation, right? Your ability to absorb oxygen and to get rid of CO2 that is being produced by all those exercising muscles. And do you believe that exercising muscles produce CO2? Oh, what organ? What organelles produce that CO2? Mitochondria in particular, due to, yeah, that Krebs cycle, right? That's working like crazy. Okay. Cholinergic stimulation. All right, so we just got done with adrenergic, right? Acetylcholine is used at all motor neuron synapses, right? That's in the somatic part of the nervous system, on skeletal muscle, all preganglionic fibers, like we saw in the previous slide, and parasympathetic postganglionics release acetylcholine. And there are two major subtypes. This is just kind of a review. Nicotinic, right, which is always excitatory, and muscarinic, which could be excitatory or inhibitory depending on how that G protein is coupled to channel protein. Right, nicotinic are stimulated by nicotine. That's why they were called that. Blocked by another compound called curare that will block a neuromuscular junction. And muscarinic are stimulated by muscarin. That's from a compound in mushrooms, and that's how muscarinic receptors were discovered, and it's blocked by a compound called atropine. Okay, so here are the two general with some subtypes of different receptors, right? So over here, we just have the typical nicotinic kind of receptor. It's a receptor channel. When this channel binds two acetylcholine molecules, it undergoes a conformation change, and it allows sodium to enter the cell. And when sodium enters the cell, what is that process? That's depolarization, right? So that's an excitatory event. So that will cause excitation in that kind of tissue, right? So this is what we call a ligand-gated channel. And the ligand here is acetylcholine. Where do we find these nicotinic receptors? All autonomic ganglia, right? Between the preganglionic and postganglionic fiber, all neuromuscular junctions, and in many central nervous system pathways, right? And in every case, they're going to be excitatory. Muscarinic, on the other hand, is not a ligand-gated channel. It works through a G-protein-coupled receptor. And so these G-proteins are activated when one molecule of acetylcholine binds to the receptor, and then these activated G-proteins can wander around inside the membrane, bump into various kinds of channels depending on the cell. Here is a potassium channel that becomes activated when a G-protein subunit bumps into it. And so potassium is going to leave the cell. Potassium leaves, what happens to the voltage inside the cell when potassium leaves? Become more positive or less positive? Less positive or more negative is another way of thinking about that. So we call that hyperpolarization, right? The membrane potential goes farther away from zero. That's hyperpolarization. And that inhibits the cell because, why is that? Why does that inhibit the cell? Why does hyperpolarization inhibit a cell? It moves it further away from threshold voltage, right? That's exactly right. So it requires even a higher level of stimulation to reach threshold, right? So that produces a slower heart rate, for instance, because the heart becomes hyperpolarized, or those cells do. Okay, another kind of muscarinic receptor right here. Once these G proteins are activated by binding of acetylcholine to this receptor, it can bump into a potassium channel, all right? And remember, there are potassium channels that are normally open, okay? There are leak channels. And if these potassium channels that are normally open are closed, what the heck is happening there? This is the first time we did like a double negative to describe a protein channel. But if this potassium channel is open, what is it doing? It's maintaining resting membrane potential or hyperpolarizing the cell. And when it closes, right, that cell now, the membrane potential starts to move up toward threshold. What do we call that when the membrane potential moves up toward threshold? Depolarization. All right, so depolarization could be due to sodium entering, or if you cut back on the amount of potassium that leaves, that will cause depolarization as well. Right, which is what? An excitatory kind of event. So that's one kind of channel that can operate in a muscarinic, or it can actually bump into a sodium channel and open up a sodium channel, which would do what? Which would depolarize the cell, which would be excitatory. All right, so it causes smooth muscles of the digestive tract to contract through either of these two mechanisms right here. Okay, now, in this particular case, what's the first messenger? Acetylcholine, right? Because it's not getting inside the cell. And I don't have any examples of second messengers, but you can see here calcium could be used as a second messenger because it enters the cell through this calcium channel. Okay. So from this slide, what should you know? That in every case, a nicotinic receptor is excitatory, and it's just a simple ligand-gated channel. A muscarinic receptor is always a G protein, and it can have either an inhibitory or excitatory effect on the tissue depending on what kind of channels are activated within the membrane, right? Whether they're potassium channels that open up or close, or sodium channels that open up. Okay, so on this list right here, I don't think I will ask you to know a lot of these things, except that what, nicotinic, right, opens a cation channel. A nicotinic and autonomic ganglia opens a cation channel. And there are different classes of muscarinic receptors because Sometimes these are what? Excitatory. Sometimes they are inhibitory. Excitatory, for instance, on smooth muscle of the digestive tract. But what is the action of acetylcholine on the heart? Is it excitatory or inhibitory? Okay, so the vagus nerve goes to the heart, releases acetylcholine on the heart, and it inhibits the heart, and it slows the heart rate down. All right, so muscarinic receptors sometimes are excitatory, sometimes inhibitory. That's really what I want you to know about this slide. And when it acts in an inhibitory way, right, it's due to opening of potassium channels that hyperpolarizes those particular cells. Oh, that's the last slide. Okay, so that's why we spent so much time on G proteins before and membrane channels, because that's how a lot of organs are controlled through the autonomic nervous system. All right, so next time, don't forget, you've got a test, not on this chapter, but on the previous chapters. What are the previous ones?
4, 5, and 7.
You got it. Okay. And the sign-in sheet. Don't forget, you got to sign the sign-in sheet, please. I got it right here. Excellent. Thank you.